Hello, this is Laura, and this is Math for Knitters. I'd like to start out this week by thanking Brenda Dane for including me in her wonderful podcast, Cast On. If you don't listen to it already, you really should. She's fantastic. Also, to the three people who left me feedback, or I guess reviews, they're reviews on iTunes. I really appreciate it. I had been, you know, waiting and waiting to finally see a review pop up, and it means a lot to me that you would take the time to do that for me. Also, to my listeners, I've been watching those stats go up, and it's really exciting to see that more than half a dozen people are bothering to listen to this. I really like it. I'm podcasting here today from beautiful Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and in case you don't know, that's spelled S-I-O-U-X, as in the Sioux, Lakota, Dakota, the Sioux Nations, Native Americans. And if you don't know that, I'd just like to tell you, because I hate ordering anything over the phone and having to spell Sioux, so please keep that in mind for the future. Because it is springtime and it is lovely here. There's a big, beautiful tree in my backyard that's blooming, and it's all lovely. But unfortunately, I do have allergies, so I'm going to be sniffling just a little bit. Hopefully not actually sneezing. And if I do, I'll just cut that out. But I'd like to start today's podcast with a confession. I was not always good at math. In fact, even when I was pursuing a degree in physics, I often said that I'm not good at math. I don't have a natural aptitude for memorization of any kind. And when I was in third grade, I actually required tutoring to learn my multiplication tables. And to this day, in order to multiply certain numbers, I have little mental tricks that my mother taught me to help me get through it. I don't actually know what 8 times 7 is, I have to figure it out, or what 9 times 6 is, I have to think through it. So just to let you know, you don't have to be naturally good at math to use it in your life, or in your studies, or in your knitting. And I really hope that I'm getting that across. Also, I would like to thank the gentleman who is responsible for the fact that I made it through my calculus courses in college. His name is Professor David Cox. Thank you. He's a wonderful, kind, exciting person. And if you go to Amherst College in Massachusetts, please take his class. He's fantastic. He actually jumps up and down, gets so excited about math that he'll hop during class. And on top of that, he was kind enough to recognize that I, for some reason, could not learn math in class. So he actually took his lunch hours to help me out for the first year that I was there. And I still deeply appreciate his help. So anyway, today I listened to last week's podcast, and I felt that I just wasn't being clear enough. And I was going to rectify that by making little samples, but my father's birthday is coming up, so I'm working on a presence for him. And I just don't have time right now to do production knitting for the show. I will do it eventually. I just don't know when. But in the meantime, I think we should walk through, or I'm going to walk you through, making yourself a worksheet. You may have seen similar to this idea. There's a wonderful worksheet available online for the incredible top-down raglan. You can find the worksheet for the incredible top-down raglan on woolworks.org. That's woolworks.org. And it walks you through the whole design process of a top-down seamless raglan sweater. This is going to be a similar idea, but a lot more simple. Just very few steps, but you do need, ideally, some paper and a pencil. I always suggest that you start any drafting sort of project or anything like that with a pencil instead of with a pen. But if you want to and you don't mind crossing things out, you can use a pen. There are good arguments for pens. They don't smudge. and especially if you're left-handed, if you have a good pen, it can be less problematic than a pencil, or so I hear. I'm not left-handed. But, so, here's your worksheet to make short rows, or to plan your short row shaping for the bust in a sweater. Now, if you don't have a bust, or you don't feel like doing this kind of shaping, then you can apply the same principles, although much, much simplified, to increasing any amount of ease in any section of your sweater. For instance, if you have, if your shoulders slope forward, then you can put some fullness in the back of your sweater for that. Also, as I mentioned last week, you can use short rows to rise or raise the back of your neck on a sweater to make it more comfortable and more windproof. So use this concept, and you can apply it anywhere you would like to have short rows if you want to figure out your short rows for yourself instead of getting it from someone else. I'm going to use some really approximate example numbers, but I will tell you it's a worksheet, so the idea is you fill in your own numbers. If you are designing a garment for the first time and you're not quite sure what sizes are going to work best for you, you could take a tape measure, and if you have, you can do it but with yourself, but you want to use a mirror, and basically you want to measure from where you want the shaping to start to where you want it to stop, and being very careful that the peak of your shaping is in the center of that 6 inches or 5 inches or 8 inches or whatever, because that's where your knitting is going to peak up. And so you want the center of the portion of your body that sticks out the most to hit that center point. So that gives you your vertical distance, and then your actual, your added distance is going to be whatever amount of fullness you want in that part of the garment. And that can be hard to perfectly estimate, but of course you can look it up online. There are garment sizing charts that say if you're a B cup, it's this, if you're a D cup, it's this. And that's a good starting point. Or I would caution, this is just a lot like waist shaping, where I would say if you were just doing this for the first time and you weren't sure, you want to underestimate how much you want. So for instance, on waist shaping, if you thought maybe you wanted 6 inches of shaping, then you, to be cautious, you might go with just 5. And the same thing with the bust. If you want 3 inches of shaping for sure, go for it. But if you think you might want 4, it's more cautious to start with 3, because knitting does stretch. This isn't woven fabric. It will move and give for you. But if you make it too full, it's really difficult for it to have a good fit that's going to look nice, and you don't want to have to necessarily start all over again. To make our worksheet, at the top of the page, write G equals row gauge, A equals original distance, and B equals added distance. Row gauge is something that we don't always talk about in knitting, because usually it's more practical to just measure your knitting as you go. So instead of saying knit 21 rows, we might say, you know, knit for 3 inches. In this case, I am going to use an example of 7 rows to an inch, which usually correlates to 5 stitches to the inch. And for me, can range from a number 6 to a number 7 needle. But of course, this is your knitting and your project, so use your numbers. So you want to make, of course, a nice big gauge swatch, which can be your sleeves, by the way, if you're making a sweater. And then measure over many inches. I would say for row gauge, you really want to watch yourself, because it's so easy to trick yourself into thinking that the row gauge is whatever you think it is. It's a very slippery little thing. So for row gauge, I actually do prefer to do this the really old-fashioned way. Get 2 pins and actually pin out 10 rows or 15 rows or 20 rows, and then measure that distance in centimeters. and then convert from centimeters to inches. And just so you know, there are 2.54 centimeters to an inch. So say your 10 stitches measures, I don't know, 10 centimeters. You want to take that 10 and divide it by 2.54, and that will give you your inches for those 10 stitches. And I know that sounds crazy, but I simply cannot get my head around fractions of inches ever. I can't do it. So since I know I can't do it, I don't try anymore. I've even been measuring something and said to someone, oh, it's 1 4/8 of an inch. And the person has looked to me and said, Laura, that's 1.5. And I've said, yes, indeed it is. Because I just can't do it. I can't handle inches. So if you're like me, you have to convert. And if you're not, then go for it. You know, I have, my hat is off to you. Now, in our example, we have 7 rows to the inch and 3 inches to add into 6 inches of original distance. So, to figure out how to do this, we are going to write A times G equals C, and keep that number. So in this case, it's 6 times 7 equals 42. And then we will have B times G divided by 2 equals D. That's the number of rows you'll have to add in, or actually the number of times that you are going to make short rows. Now, that factor of 2, you might be wondering why it's there, is there because of the nature of short rows. You can't really, as far as I know, accomplish one short row at a time. I think that they look best when they are worked in pairs. So in an example, if we only had 20 stitches across our sweater, then we might work the first 19 stitches, wrap and turn, work back for 18 stitches, wrap and turn, and then that would be our first set of short rows. If you do this, you'll see that you're basically leaving off one stitch on each side. I like to stagger my short rows because I feel that it looks better that way. So then I might knit my plain rows, whatever their number is, and then work, for instance, 18 stitches, leaving 2 behind, and then 18 and then 17. Is that right? 18 and 16. Wait, I have to figure this out. If I'm leaving 2 behind, so I have 18 and then I turn, yeah, and then I have to work 16 to leave 2 on the other end. Now, often I find it much easier to think in terms of the stitches that I am leaving behind than in the stitches that I am working. So I might write to myself a little note, you know, this is my first short row set, so I'll be leaving 1 stitch behind. Second set, 2 stitches. Third set, 3 stitches. If you find staggering it differently works better for you, that is your option. When I get halfway through my short rows, I will go in the other way. So say I worked up to leaving 10 behind, which obviously wouldn't work in this example, but if I left 7 behind, and then I would leave 6, and then 5, and then 4, until I get back to 1. I just feel this produces a nice round look in a way that isn't too sloppy on the edges of it. Experiment. You may find your way is better. So, in this case, we take our C and divide by D, which gives us the number of rows, of plain knit rows in between our short rows. So, for our example, 3 times 7 equals 21, that's B times G, divided by 2 is approximately 10. And yes, I do think rounding here is acceptable. So, then we need to divide 42 by 10, which gives us 4.2. And we come to the question of rounding. In science, we use a system that's very strict about how you round. I find in knitting it's best to think about what you're doing and decide then what is the appropriate way to round. In this case, you're going to be rounding up, which is rounding up the number of rows you have in between your short rows, which gives you a more gradual curve, but may also require you to actually change the number of short rows you are going to do. In our example, we have 10 sets of short rows. Now, if I decided I wanted them to be 5 rows apart, then that would make my total shaping 50 rows long, which is 8 rows longer than I originally planned, which is about an inch, which is not really a big deal unless that makes my shaping sit an inch too high or an inch too low on my chest. I find in these cases it is extremely valuable to get a piece of paper and draw out what the heck I'm doing with the distances between everything. If I want the maximum point of my weight of my shaping in my bust to hit exactly where my bust is the largest, which is where I want it, I need to know that distance from that point to the top of the sweater, or from that point to the bottom of the sweater, and I need to make sure that it's going to fall the way that I want it to fall. So just watch yourself very carefully. The whole point of this exercise is to think about your knitting. So think about it, draw it, do the math, make sure that you've made all your calculations correctly, and you'll be fine. So that's it for short row shaping of the bust. I believe when I do a neckline, it doesn't require an up and a down. I just generally go up. So if I was adding more depth or height to the back of my sweater, I might add 3 to 5 short rows, which between a half inch and an inch of short row shaping, anywhere in the last, say, 10 to 15 rounds of the sweater. I also would like to talk a little bit more about a previous episode. I spoke earlier about hat shaping in my first episode, and I said to get a flat anything, you needed to use 8 decreases or increases every other round. I recently got a book, a beautiful book called Heirloom Knitting, which is it was written by Sharon Miller, and I actually got it through interlibrary loan. Sadly, I don't own it, but I will, I'm sure, very soon. I love this book. And I think because she's working in lace with very firm blocking and very thin yarn, I actually did notice that the centers of her circular shawls had either 6 or 7 segments to them, so 6 or 7 increases every other round. Or it could even be every round. I didn't look closely enough. So I guess I'd just like to say that there's really no hard and fast rule about shaping, but, you know, I still feel pretty strongly that in worsted weight yarn, when you're not going to severely block it, in order to get a nice flat shape, you need 8 every other round or every other row. If I'm wrong, feel free to tell me in the comments on the show's blog. The website for that is www.math4knitters, that's the number 4, .blogspot.com. I really enjoy hearing your comments. And so that's that. So that's a serious segment of the show. For the less serious segment, which is going to be short, I would just love to rave about this book, Heirloom Knitting. On this Schoolhouse Press website, they say $55, you know, represents years of research. And I believe that even though $55 is a lot of money for a book, this book is worth every penny. You could seriously spend the rest of your life knitting only projects from this book, and that's not at all a bad thing. There are the shawls and other things like that that you would expect, but there are also really adorable baby jackets that are just gorgeous. There's my little rave about this book. Also, I would like to inform the world about a movie that I just saw yesterday called An American Haunting, which, how much did I like it? Let's see. It was a little cheesy, I thought, and one of my friends that went with me actually caught a little nap in the movie, which isn't really the most positive thing when it's supposed to be a horror film. And to be honest, I didn't really find it that scary, except for the end I did find very disturbing when they explained why they thought the poltergeist activity may have been happening. I just, that kind of thing bothers me quite a lot, and if you've seen it, you know what I mean. And if you haven't, I don't want to ruin it for you, but I am going to tell you about the knitting in the movie. Nobody in the movie knits in the movie, but, oh my gosh. Okay, it was set in Tennessee in the 1800s, I believe, and the mother keeps wearing this fantastic garter stitch shawl with neck shaping. I mean, I spent the whole movie completely distracted by the clothing, which I gather wasn't a bad thing, according to my napping friend. And she was just wearing this, it was a dark wool and it was garter stitch, but it had this wonderful little shaping on the bottom, like someone had increased and decreased it to make kind of waves. And this collar, it had like a little collar on it. And it was a triangular garter stitch shawl knit, vertically so that the ridges were vertical, and it was very stretchy. And the mother wears it quite a lot, and it was just, I just loved staring. I was just staring at it the whole movie. Also, there's a scene with the daughter's friend, has a friend staying with her in her bed, and in the night she's woken up by a nightmare, and then other various things happen. And the friend was wearing the most adorable little bed jacket. It was so cute. It was like not quite to the elbow, it looked like. And it had kind of a eyelet lace, very simple eyelet lace pattern on it. And it was stockinette stitched mostly in a very, I wouldn't say very fine yarn, but maybe a DK or even a fingering weight. And it was just a absolute masterpiece. I couldn't get enough of looking at that sweater. So if anyone knows the progeny of those sweaters, or knows where the patterns can be bought or if they have been made, I would love to hear about it. Also, you know, anybody wants to tell me anything about the podcast, of course, email me. My email address, you have to be careful, is Lara Neal, LaraNeeL, at mac.com. You have to spell it right and then you're golden. I have to say that a lot. So that's my podcast for this week. I really appreciate everybody tuning in, and I don't know, I think next... No, I'm not going to say what next week is going to be about because I don't know yet, but I'll think about it and I will let you know. Also, I don't usually play music on the show, but I love this song, and I wrote to the publicist of the guy who did this song, and they sent me a CD very, very kindly. So I'm going to play this for you. I heard it a couple of years ago on the radio, and it's so sad and so beautiful and so melodic that I want to share it with you. It's by a man named Enoch Kent, and I'll have a link to his website on the show notes. And the song is called Edinburgh Maggie, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful song, and I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, bye.
Our Maggie was a wandering lass when first she came to Edinburgh town, and the story how she lived and died. If you hear me out, it will you astound. A woman who owned a nearby inn was kind to Maggie and took her in. Gave her a job, she was paid and fed, and a woman's son took Maggie to bed. Oh, what joys they had with one another, till Maggie said, I'm to be a mother. The young man lied about their plans, for that very night he got up and he ran. I ran and he left poor Maggie there, and it was more than a child that she had to bear, for hiding a bastard beneath her gown. Church and state would put her down. Maggie sweated every day, and she'd lie awake at night and pray. But she had the child so very well that nobody knew except herself. Then one morning in her wee bedroom, a small boy came from Maggie's womb, so thin and weak that Maggie cried. Within 3 days, her baby died. In panic, Maggie looked around to find a decent burial ground. She found a spot nearby the inn, dug the grave and put her baby in. As Maggie prayed and as she mourned, a servant, the sheriff's gone, then adding to her awful pain, Maggie was led on chains. "You're now found guilty of a dreadful act," said the judge, all dressed in legal black. "You hid your pregnancy from our eyes. By this court and the church, you are despised. You'll be taken from here in deep disgrace and hanged by the neck in the marketplace." Maggie looked at the man in black, kind of man would pass a law like that. The market was packed way a grumbling mass, people all of Maggie's class. No one cheered, Maggie fell like lead. A doctor then pronounced her dead. Some medical students from the town claimed Maggie's body as their own. From all dead felons they could choose, when they tried to take Maggie, all hell broke loose. The crowd were all on Maggie's side. More disgraceful acts they would not abide. The students were belted with bottles and stones. They retreated to cure their own broken bones. Some asked, "Why did Maggie have to die?" as they lifted her frail body high and placed her in their funeral crate, in spite of threats from church and state. To the pauper's grave the cartwheels groaned, when from the casket they heard a moan. They prized the lid and to their surprise found poor Maggie still alive. Oh, Maggie had beaten the hangman's rope and showed that even beggars can have hope. But when she spoke, their mouths went slack, because what she said was, "I'm going back. If you go back, you'll be killed again by that big wig judge and all his men." Maggie answered with a nod, "I'll show them that they did me do their job." She marched with her crowd into the square, the gibbet and rope still standing there. The sheriff's men stayed at their posts. None wanted to touch a new-made ghost. The clergy clucked like baffled hens, then said, "She'll need to be hanged again." A lawyer stopped their hellish plot. by standing and saying, "You're damn well not." He said a doctor did decide that after hanging, Maggie had died, now in the sight of God and men. A dead body you're not allowed to hang again. In Edinburgh town she still has fame. Off Hang It Maggie is her name, and how church and state try to put her down for hiding a baby beneath her gown. How Maggie lived on, we'll never know. After she heard the words, "You're free to go," but on hearing this tale, many have cursed and spat, saying, "What kind of man would pass a law like that? Aye, what kind of man would pass a law like that?"